It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear the arguments for and against teaching computer coding in all schools across the country.
First, Donald Trump is campaigning in Wisconsin today with stops scheduled in Milwaukee, La Crosse, and West Bend.
Then is a return visit for Donald Trump. He and vice presidential running mate Mike Pence have made several visits to the Badger State since Trump became the official GOP nominee for president, which makes some political observers wonder how Wisconsin fits into Trump's overall campaign strategy.
With us now is Craig Gilbert, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington bureau chief. He also writes a blog about politics and elections called Wisconsin Voter. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Well, we're seeing a lot of Trump activity here in Wisconsin, clearly, but the latest polling shows a big lead for Hillary Clinton. Does Donald Trump apparently think he has a chance to overcome that lost ground and have a chance at winning in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, what's interesting about Wisconsin is there is this disconnect between the polling and a lot of other kind of anecdotal evidence that this is a tough state for Trump, that his support is soft here, that it's going to be a challenge for him to compete here. On the other hand, Wisconsin demographically fits into how he's trying to expand his voter base. We have a disproportionate number of white blue-collar voters, which is his strength. And also geographically, it sort of fits into where he's trying to expand the map, which is the upper Midwest, partly because of the demographics. Places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, he needs to expand the map because he's got fewer opportunities in some states that used to be more reliably Republican that are now purple or blue-leaning in the Southwest, in the Southeast. The map has become harder in other places, and so by necessity, Republicans are turning to the upper Midwest, where there is a set of states that, even though they've been voting Democratic, have been relatively competitive in recent cycles.
Yeah, Craig, as Donald Trump's campaign is doing its electoral college map, how important is Wisconsin in getting to 270+1?
Well, it's not as important as Pennsylvania, for example. Pennsylvania is bigger, and it was actually closer in the last election. And so you've seen him really lavish attention on Pennsylvania, because without Pennsylvania, the map just looks almost impossible for Donald Trump. So Wisconsin is another state like Pennsylvania where it would be really helpful to the math. He doesn't have as many paths to victory mathematically as Hillary Clinton has, because when you look at how he's doing in places like Colorado and Virginia, if those states are lost to him, he's got a narrower and narrower path. I mean, he has to win Ohio and Florida under any circumstances. So Wisconsin could be helpful. I mean, you know, in 2004, which was the last George W. Bush election, Wisconsin played a really important role. It was an absolute top target of the Republicans because they were worried about losing Ohio, and they could have afforded a loss in Ohio had they won Wisconsin. So there are scenarios under which Wisconsin could play a similar role this time around. It's just that it's been politically a struggle for Donald Trump.
According to media reports, Governor Scott Walker may be attending these Trump events today. Here's what he had to say earlier about Donald Trump.
A lot of it's going to depend on whether or not the focus is on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, or whether or not the national media talks about sideshow issues. If Donald Trump can keep the focus on her and give speeches like he gave yesterday, where he clearly lays out a very presidential approach as to how he's going to address important issues like the security and safety of our nation, he can win. If he gets off on other issues, it becomes much more difficult.
How important is what Donald Trump says in Wisconsin to the effectiveness of his speech? If he stays on message, does that help sell him to maybe reluctant Republican voters?
It certainly doesn't hurt. I mean, what was interesting about the governor's comments was there was kind of a shot at the media, but there was also a shot at Donald Trump. I mean, he was kind of saying, you know, if the media is going to always talk about these side issues, translation, you know, controversial things that Donald Trump has said, and then in the next breath he put it on Trump, which is Donald Trump's got to stop saying stuff like this if he's going to run an effective campaign. Wisconsin's a state we've seen where voters don't seem to sort of warm up to that style of campaigning, the kind of adversarial, slashing, just kind of addiction to controversy. I think that may be one of the reasons he struggled here. And so Scott Walker is saying, you know, make it about Hillary Clinton, not about the things you said yesterday on the campaign trail.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about Donald Trump's visits really to Wisconsin today and his path to Electoral College victory, which may need to include Wisconsin. Wisconsin wouldn't hurt if you were able to win it anyway. Craig, we've been talking about Wisconsin as one thing so far. You've spent a lot of your career breaking things down. Can you spell out the Donald Trump political geography here in the state?
Yeah, so it's interesting. If you look at the map and you look at the polling, there's so much polling in Wisconsin that we can actually get down into some detail about the different place air regions of the state. And right now, Donald Trump is actually performing better than Mitt Romney did 4 years ago in northern Wisconsin, including the Green Bay market, which is a huge, which is a big market. It's a really vital part of the state politically. And he's, in the last poll by Marquette, he was up by double digits in the Green Bay market. His problem is that where you would expect a Republican to be strong, which is all the counties kind of north and west of Milwaukee, including the very, very, very Republican counties of Waukesha, Washington, Ozaukee, but also including some of these Republican-leaning counties that aren't quite as red, like Sheboygan and Walworth and Dodge and Jefferson. This is really the Republican heartland, and this is an area where Republicans, if you add it all up together, need to win not only by double digits, but in some cases by high double digits or in the 20s. I mean, Governor Walker kind of won this region by almost 30 points when he ran for governor, and President Bush, in almost winning Wisconsin, won it by almost 20 points. But Donald Trump is at parity there now with Hillary Clinton. That's really a very bad sign for a Republican, because that's where so many Republican votes are. You need those voters not only to vote in large margins for Republicans, but you need them to turn out, because they do. They have turned out in the past. They're some of the most engaged voters in the country, but turnout is a real concern for him just because the enthusiasm isn't there. So that's his biggest challenge in the map. And, you know, the other side of the equation, which, you know, we've been talking about Donald Trump, but Hillary Clinton is the other side of the equation. And one reason Donald Trump is running really, really well in Green Bay is that she's very unpopular up there. And that's one thing that Donald Trump can point to in coming to a place like Wisconsin. That's one opening, one sign of opportunity, is that Hillary Clinton is also weak in Wisconsin.
Those counties you mentioned outside of Milwaukee County, they're also the heartland of the Never Trump movement, it seemed like, back at primary time, who delivered Wisconsin for Ted Cruz. People who, as you say, supported Governor Walker, who support Paul Ryan, not wild about things that Donald Trump has said about Governor Walker and Paul Ryan since this campaign began. As you watch polling, what are you watching for to see if that demographic starts saying, okay, he's still the Republican, we're going to vote for him?
Well, one thing to watch is what are attitudes toward Trump among Republican voters statewide. And what we saw it kind of hit a low point during the primary where, you know, fewer than 40% of Republican voters in the state of Wisconsin had a favorable impression of Donald Trump, which is pretty remarkable. That climbed up in June and July into the 50s and even the 60s, but it slipped again in August. This past month, those weeks of controversy after the conventions cost Donald Trump, and his support within his own party in Wisconsin receded by about a half a dozen points in the polling. And so that's one thing to keep an eye on. I mean, there was this interesting episode, you mentioned Paul Ryan, where Donald Trump kind of started a feud with Paul Ryan for no apparent reason on the eve of Paul Ryan's primary last week. And Paul Ryan proceeded to win it handily. And not only that, but if you look at, like, one of these counties we've been talking about, Waukesha County, which is the most important Republican county in the state, by a ratio of 9-1, those people voted for Ryan against a pro-Trump Republican challenger who Trump had praised. So there's an indication of you know, the fact that there's not a big Trump movement in that part of the state. People are more loyal to Wisconsin Republicans like Walker and Ryan, and there is some real softness in Trump's support there that he hasn't and he hasn't solved that problem yet. So take a, so keep an eye on how he's doing within his own party. Keep an eye on how he's doing in southeastern Wisconsin.
And Craig, as we wrap up, Donald Trump has definitely pointed to himself as a law and order, public safety candidate. He is here. He'll be in Milwaukee just after this weekend's unrest, after police shooting. He's meeting with police actually in Milwaukee today, I understand. How do you see a situation like the one in Milwaukee impacting the Trump campaign and voter perceptions of him?
I don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what he has to say about it. It's a tricky issue for all the candidates. You don't want to be seen as politicizing it. It's racially divisive. It's sensitive. He has, you know, in his speech at the convention, you know, he called himself the law and order candidate. He kind of told a pretty dark story about safety and security in this country, and that's been one of his campaign themes. So we probably will hear him talk about this. It's another question as to how it sort of cuts politically. I'm not really sure. I mean, it's just, I think there's some risk on both sides in how you approach this issue, whether you're looking at, whether you're putting the onus on the police for how they're policing, or whether you're putting the onus, whether you're speaking about it in kind of law and order terms. On the other hand, it's tricky, and I don't see this necessarily as an issue that is going to move a ton of votes, but it is an issue that sort of reveals something about the candidates in terms of the way they talk about it.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Great to be with you.
That's Craig Gilbert. He's in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look at the fate of the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay under a possible President Trump or Clinton.
First, there's a nationwide push underway to make computer coding an essential part of school curriculums. In his State of the Union address earlier this year, the president said schools should be, quote, offering the students the hands-on computer science and math classes that make them job-ready on day one. Coding is expected to be a huge part of that, and advocates say that teaching kids coding today will prepare them for the jobs of tomorrow.
But as our next guest points out, there are still some pretty steep logistical challenges facing the Coding for All movement, things like a shortage of teachers, a non-universal curriculum, and disparities in students' access to computers.
There's also an argument that coding is too narrow a focus, one that's being pushed by business leaders, maybe not for the right reasons. So what's the solution? Is coding really the answer?
Annie Murphy-Paul joins us now. She's an author, magazine journalist, consultant, and speaker. Her latest piece for Scientific American is called The Coding Revolution. Annie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with the argument that all kids should learn coding in school. What is the thinking behind that argument?
Well, the idea is that this is the quintessential job of the future, that this is something that almost everybody should need to know, will need to know, and that in particular, this could be a way of lifting up disadvantaged communities, because there's going to be a big need for people to fill these jobs, and we can help that the cause of equality along by training all of America's kids, maybe especially economically disadvantaged and minority kids, so that they have access to this enormous opportunity that people in the technology world see opening up.
And right now, how close are we to that goal of universal coding in all schools?
We are really, really far away. Just to give you a sense, the advanced placement test in computer science is given at only 4,310 U.S. high schools, and that's 12% of American high schools. So even if we were to commit to teaching every student how to code, there literally would not be nearly enough teachers who are trained and ready to take on that responsibility.
So from the educator perspective, what would need to happen to prepare enough educators to accomplish this kind of universal coding?
Well, one approach might be to build education in computer science into teacher training programs, into schools of education. There might be some kind of a massive effort to retrain teachers who are already on the job. And we could perhaps persuade people who have this expertise already to go into teaching, although that's another challenge. Because there's such demand for people who can program, most people who have those skills are going to be out there in the workforce, not in the public schools, but in, you know, gravitating towards Silicon Valley.
And it also sounds like, based on research done in 2008, that not all coding education is created equal and not all kids are going to be getting the same education when it comes to coding. And what kind of problems do you see there with this idea of virtual segregation?
Right. There's some really interesting and important research done by a woman named Jane Margulies at UCLA. She looked at the computer science education that's typically offered to white, affluent, suburban public school students, and then compared that to the computer science education offered to predominantly minority, urban, more disadvantaged school districts. And she found that the latter students were getting a kind of cut-and-paste, like, here's how you use a word processing program, not very in-depth, not very cumulative. It didn't build on itself, whereas the more privileged students who already probably had access to this kind of tutoring or, you know, skill building at home, they were also getting much more comprehensive and in-depth and also creative and exciting and fun instruction in computer science in their schools. So then, you know, the predictable outcome of that is that many more affluent white, often male students go into computer science, and we say, well, that's the product of their choice. That's their that's what they've gravitated towards, when really the opportunities to learn and to enjoy and to identify with computer science were never equal in the first place.
We're talking with Annie Murphy-Paul right now. She has a new piece in Scientific American. It's called The Coding Revolution. And Annie, in terms of access to the materials, computers in this case, how big a problem is it getting equal access beyond something like a smartphone or a tablet, equal access for all students?
Yeah, I think it's a common assumption that, you know, this is the digital generation. They all have computers. They all have Wi-Fi access, and it's simply not true. In fact, there was a really poignant op-ed in the New York Times a couple days ago by the man who, Tony Marks, who is in charge of the New York City Public Libraries, and he was pointing out that there are kids who hang out on the steps of the Bronx Library, public library, after it has closed, so that they can pick up some of the Wi-Fi signal that's leaking, you know, sort of accidentally out of the building, because that's the only way they can do their homework, which is largely online. They don't have access to computers at home. And I, for the interview, for the article in Scientific American, I talked to a teacher at a inner city high school in Los Angeles, who said that while most of her students do have smartphones, and they use them for texting and games and Snapchat and Facebook, that's an entirely different thing from knowing how to really use a computer for all the applications that one would that we all use computers for in our professional lives, in our personal lives. The digital divide may look different than it used to, but it's still definitely there.
And you write about some critics who say that all of this emphasis on getting kids in all schools to learn how to code, that it's too narrow a focus. So what do they mean by that?
Well, one concern is that, you know, there are specific coding languages that may be in vogue right now. Those seem to change fairly often. Even professional programmers have to be keeping up with you know, the latest coding language. And it may be that if we're teaching, say, fourth graders today a coding language that won't exist when they're graduating and going into the workforce, that perhaps that's not as good a use of their educational time as some kind of more broad-based approach to understanding computers and how they work. So ultimately, in my article, I ended up focusing on something called computational thinking, which is a term that describes learning about computers as a discipline, as a way of approaching problems, solving problems, dealing with information. All these capabilities that are going to be important for everyone in a way that perhaps knowing a specific coding language isn't going to be as useful.
Computational thinking sounds broader. It also sounds more abstract. Is there a curriculum developed already around that idea of computational thinking?
Schools are working on that. There's no kind of agreed upon curriculum. It's all kind of emerging as we speak. But I did interview a number of people from a school district in Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania, that has woven computational thinking into every class and every grade, and that means teaching students how to approach problems and subject matter in the way that a computer scientist would approach it. Gathering data, testing hypotheses, iterating and trying new things and seeing what works, breaking things down and then building your model back up. And they've had a lot of success with it. Now, again, this is a more affluent, more highly educated community that is around the universities that are at the core of Pittsburgh. But there was another school that I looked at in Washington State where, interestingly, they're just outside Seattle, where there are all these tech giants, and yet these students who are, many of whom speak English as a second language and who are economically disadvantaged, they feel very cut off from this shiny tech world that is, you know, just across town. And there, too, they are learning computational thinking, and they have a computational thinking program manager whose job it is to collaborate with teachers who teach specific subjects, whether it's math or history or English, and weave computational thinking into those courses. And so people are trying all different kinds of things. I think right now, as usual, the American educational system is not unified in any sense. People are doing all different kinds of approaches, and that means that it's both a laboratory for innovation in many ways, but also that there are a whole lot of students who aren't getting any computer science education at all.
Annie, thanks so much for joining us. That was Annie Murphy-Paul, who's an author, magazine journalist, consultant, and speaker. Her latest piece, The Coding Revolution in Scientific American.
Coming up, Guantanamo Bay under a new president. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court will most likely be filled by the next president. We'll talk to a political scientist about how this open seat is affecting the November election.
First, at the start of his presidency, President Obama pledged to shut down the detention facility at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay. The facility still exists. As of yesterday, has 61 detainees still there. As the race for the president continues, the future of the facility has yet to be seen. Last week, Republican nominee Donald Trump spoke to a Miami Herald reporter about keeping the facility open and even trying Americans there.
As far as Guantanamo is concerned, I want to make sure, 100% sure, that if we're going to release people, number one, they're going to be people that can be released, and it's going to be safe to release them. And we have plenty of bad ones out there, and I would use it for that.
Would you try to get the military commissions, the trial court there, to try U.S. citizens?
Well, I know that they want to try them in our regular court systems, and I don't like that at all. I don't like that at all. I would say they could be tried there. I would be fine.
In serving as Secretary of State under the Obama administration, Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton has supported moves to close the facility, though she hasn't spoken about the issue much since being on the campaign trail.
Joining us now to tell us more about the future of the detention facility is Michael Newton. He's a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. He focuses on things like terrorism, accountability, transnational justice, and conduct of hostilities issues. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's good to be here.
Before we get to a possible Trump or Clinton presidency, let's talk about the Obama presidency and Guantanamo. One of his opening agenda items was closing it. It is not closed. Why has it been so hard to close the facility at Guantanamo?
Well, it's enormously complex in terms of the legal issues, and I know I sound like a law professor. During the latter part of the Bush second term, There was a huge effort to move out and transfer detainees. At one time, there were close to 800 detainees at Guantanamo. So what you've seen is an acceleration of that. You can't close it until you get to zero, in essence, because of one statutory constraint that prohibits transfer of detainees to U.S. soil. So until you solve that problem, you can't really close it unless you're just willing to open the floodgates and let them all out. And that would include people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the planner of 9/11, and many other people who have been determined to represent severe continuing security threats. So that's the challenge.
As you mentioned, hundreds of people are now no longer in Guantanamo. Just yesterday we saw the news, 15 will be sent to the United Arab Emirates. But as we get down to this last five dozen or so, is the fact that they're still there, does that mean they're the ones that a solution is under present American law and present international conditions pretty much impossible to move?
Not impossible, just extremely difficult. The number that I've seen, and it fluctuates or it can fluctuate based on new security reviews, is that about 34 have been determined to be ineligible for release on law of war grounds, that they represent a continuing threat. And that, of course, is an issue that is irrespective of party or irrespective of president, right? The president swears to support and defend the Constitution and protect the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So that core group of real threats to America, it's pretty hard to see any president saying, oh, no big deal, just, you know, go do whatever you're going to do and we'll be fine with that. Now, what happens to that smaller group is a matter of great controversy, whether they're prosecuted in a number of other forums or prosecuted in other countries or held indefinitely under the authority of the laws of war. Those are all very complex questions that we have to work out and work out in conjunction with our allies.
Talking to Michael Newton from the Vanderbilt Law School, looking at the future of the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay and the two most likely next presidents of the United States. And Mike, let's get to them now. Donald Trump, as we just heard, said he'd be fine, keeping Guantanamo open. He said he wants to put lots more, the phrase is bad dudes there. And in that bit, we heard that he would be open to American citizens being tried at the Guantanamo facility in military tribunals. How does that fit into current American law and practice?
Well, the easy answer, the second and first, of course, with respect to American citizens, the Military Commissions Act prohibits trials of American citizens in the military commissions. Now, that could be changed, theoretically. American citizens, and there's a whole prior wave of jurisprudence that says American citizens have a baseline set of constitutional rights that are best protected in normal Article III courts, in other words, normal federal criminal courts. So hey, that would require statutory change. But underlying the idea of keeping Guantanamo open is another idea that hasn't really been talked about much. For people who propose closure, the question is, what do you propose instead of Guantanamo, right? So there's a moral hazard that says we're not going to capture anybody, we're just going to kill them. And that's a morally difficult place to go. On the other hand, where there are known threats, you say, you know, as General Petraeus used to say, you can't kill or capture your way out of this. You've got to have a long-term strategy for minimizing and eliminating the terrorist threat. And so, you know, addressing the core problem at Guantanamo is a concrete part of that strategy. And I'll say, reiterate again, it's got to be done in conjunction with our allies because there's a great deal of legal uncertainty here.
Looking at our allies and other countries around the world, a lot of people have pointed toward Guantanamo as a moral difficulty, a black eye for the United States and the international community. Is that symbolic part of it, an important part of the story?
Well, there's no doubt that in the early days, Guantanamo both stained our reputation dramatically, but also strained our alliances, strained our relationships. People who are on the inside often squirm under that because they'll say, well, wait a minute. You know, we did everything we could do to do it right. We just did it hastily and made some mistakes. And I could catalog those mistakes if you're interested. But in large sense, that's ancient history. I mean, today, Guantanamo, the facility itself, is built to the standards of the most top-of-the-line federal penitentiaries. It's one of the best, most advanced detention systems in the world. The International Committee of the Red Cross is there and has been there from very early on. But the permanent legacy of the place is unmistakably tarred. It's sort of a non-biodegradable symbol of U.S. malfeasance in the early days of the war. But, you know, that's a long time ago.
Does it matter if we come up with a new facility not in the 50 states proper, you know, somewhere else in an American possession in the world where similar rules apply as they do at Guantanamo? And it's the same thing, it just doesn't have the name Guantanamo attached to it anymore?
Yeah, not really. I mean, the real fear among human rights advocates is that the law here, which is so unsettled, remember, in an armed conflict, in a time of war, under the laws of war, you're absolutely entitled, and it's the responsible thing to do when you capture people, to hold them until the end of hostilities. That's just well-settled law. Here we're in a state of a very different kind of armed conflict, and I use the term permawar. So you can't just, in human rights law, say it doesn't matter where you're held, we're just going to keep holding you as long as we want to hold you, as long as it's convenient. You've got to solve the core underlying problem. And there's still disputes among the allies about the precise legal basis. Is it pure human rights law? If so, that drives you down one complex set of analysis. Is it just law of war? So in a sense, it doesn't matter. I do think it would be helpful to shift out of Guantanamo just for symbolic reasons. But if all we're doing is symbolism, we're not really solving the core underlying problem.
Is there precedent out there that helps us think about this problem? As you say, this isn't a war as we think of it, where one side surrenders, the war is over, now we deal with those people we still have in custody. This is a sort of hostility that could be going for our lifetimes, really.
Well, that's right. And in that sense, it really doesn't do much good to outsource the problem. You know, there are basically three dimensions of law here that are working and kind of interlocked at the same time, which is why this is such a complex set of problems. One is the basic authority to detain people, as opposed to the right under the laws of war to conduct hostilities. And if you're purely in that domain, there's a clear-cut set of answers. You know, for the public who doesn't understand this, that would mean that they would simply be labeled prisoners of war, and therefore there's a whole very straight black-letter body of law that says what do prisoners of war get. Well, these people don't meet those definitions, but neither are they pure civilians, to which human rights law applies in its purest sense. They are in the middle ground, and I do think we need some new law here. Now, in the context of actual operations in Afghanistan, for example, we have reached some pretty concrete developments. What hasn't happened is that those developments from the battlefield have transferred back to Guantanamo in terms of practices.
You said we need new law here. Who would that come from? Is it the international community? Is it Congress? Who needs to be generating new law on these kinds of, not civilians, not combatants, but whatever we have there?
Right. Well, there's several different pieces. One are clear statutory changes. You know, for example, as I said, if a future president wished to try American citizens in the military commissions, that would require statutory change. If there was any movement, which would generate some cost savings, towards moving people back into the United States, that would require a statutory change. And a lot of people point to the example in World War II. You know, we did have German prisoners of war on American soil, just near to Vanderbilt, right here in Tennessee. And they say, well, see, it's feasible, it's possible. But remember, this is a bipartisan issue. I don't know of any senator who stood up and demanded that we close Guantanamo and offered the prison, the federal prison, in his or her backyard as the appropriate holding place. DOD has said that if they transfer detainees back to the United States, they want a centralized place. So there's statutory changes. On the international law side, what you have is a sort of a conflicting welter of treaties. The law of war right to hold people is one piece of that. But then when you decide to transfer them, there are other pieces of treaty law. So the Torture Convention, for example, prohibits the United States or any other country from transferring someone to a place where we know they'll be subjected to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. So, you know, we have to work through those things with diplomatic assurances and with agreements, and they're very complex agreements. So in a way, what we're really doing is outsourcing the responsibility to some other country, whether it's UAE or Ghana or any other, lots of places. We've transferred people to over 30 countries in the world now.
We're talking to Mike Newton, professor at Vanderbilt Law School, looking at the future of Guantanamo Bay as the race for president continues.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you think that the 15 detainees who were transferred out of the facility yesterday should have been released? And what did you think of Donald Trump saying that he would be fine with American citizens being tried before a military tribunal at Guantanamo Bay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And what do you think of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton's stance on the detention facility? Call 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up that conversation, look at what Hillary Clinton has said about Guantanamo, coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Michael Newton, professor at Vanderbilt Law School, about the future of Guantanamo Bay under a potential President Trump or President Clinton.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you think the president should continue to try to shut down the facility at the tail end of his presidency? Have you changed your views on whether or not the facility should be shut down, maybe over the last few years? And what do you think about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton's stance on Guantanamo? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mike, we talked a little bit about what Donald Trump has had to say. Now, Hillary Clinton was part of the Obama administration, then supported the idea of closing Guantanamo. Has not been front and center, people have been saying, on the campaign trail, though. What do you think, looking at what Hillary Clinton has said and done, Guantanamo might look like under a Hillary Clinton presidency?
Well, I've had friends who ask me, as soon as each transfer is announced, they excitedly call me and they say, see, we're getting closer to closing Guantanamo. And for me, until you solve the core legal issues underlying that, there's no real meaningful movement towards closing. And that core issue is, what do you do with the hardcore group, roughly 34 to 35, that you simply cannot release under any conceivable context? You can't get sufficient security guarantees. You can't either that, or you can't get sufficient humane treatment guarantees. It's hard to see a President Clinton who would simply say, no problem, those 34, current recidivism rates estimate between 20 and 30%. So let's assume five of those go back to the hostilities. Well, those are really, really major threats to the United States. It's hard to see a President Clinton saying that and then in the next breath saying, but if they do bad things, we could authorize drone strikes or special operations forces. The whole point is that you have them in custody. And the question then is, what do you do with them? That's what we have to work out with our allies and with the Congress.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Steve is on the line in Wausau. Steve, hi.
Hi there. I was, from memory, there was a Supreme Court decision, wasn't there, back in the 40s, about the military can't try civilians in a military commission? And as a second point, could the professor discuss the difference in international law between a uniformed and a non-uniformed opponent? Thank you. I'll listen off the air.
Steve, thanks for the call. A couple of big questions there. First, he says, is there precedent looking back to the 40s, I assume World War II era, from the Supreme Court on these issues, Mike?
Well, there is, and that's one of the things people go back to. Trials in the Justice Department under military commissions, one of whom was an American citizen, and the Supreme Court upheld that. The challenge being, in this context, that the Military Commissions Act prohibits exactly that. It says only non-American citizens as a statutory matter. But the other thing that's different is the nature of the conflict. World War II is fairly straightforward. You have an international armed conflict between two states, and so you had personnel on behalf of the Germans in civilian clothes, and it was easy to lump them under other categories of international law because they certainly didn't get prisoner of war status, which every other captured German in uniform did. This is a different kind of conflict, which means there's a wholly different applicable body of law, and that makes it a lot more complicated.
Right. And then his other question about combatant in a uniform versus combatant not in a uniform in the war, say, in Afghanistan. It wasn't the Afghani army the United States was at war with, but it was an organized military effort that was resisting the United States there. How are those combatants, but not state combatants, treated under international law?
Right. Well, the technical legal term here, just not to sound too much like a law professor, but there's no such thing as a combatant in a non-international armed conflict. In other words, combatant, although we use it in the media, we use it around our dinner tables, is a legally loaded term. And when you say somebody is a combatant, what you're really saying is that they have met the requirements under international law and are fighting in a conflict involving two states. So the legal thing that goes with that is the right to conduct hostilities, and therefore, whatever you've done that's in compliance with the laws of war is not, by definition, criminal. So let's put that in layman speak. What it means is that a terrorist who attacks the Pentagon, which otherwise would have been a lawful target in the law of war, didn't do anything wrong, is entitled to combatant's privilege. So the point is, combatant is a very technical legal term reserved exclusively for conflicts between states. And to see the symmetry here, because these people are not combatants in the legal sense, when we capture them, by definition, they're not prisoners of war. There's a boatload of other terms. They're unlawful belligerents, unlawful participants. Civilians taking direct part in hostilities is the phrase from the Geneva Convention Protocols of 1977. There's a whole raft of other terms, but combatant or unlawful combatant is not one. If you're a combatant, by definition, you're a lawful combatant because it's a legally significant term.
Steve, thanks for bringing those issues up at 800-642-1234. As we talk about the future of Guantanamo under the next president, whoever that might be, you can join in, 800-642-1234. Michael Newton is our guest from Vanderbilt Law School. Well, it seems like the conflicts of today and probably tomorrow are going to be more like what we're talking about, the United States versus a militia in Afghanistan, the United States versus a group like ISIS or its successors. Why is it taking us so long to get the legal fine points ironed out here since we've been at this for, what, 15 years or so?
Good question. Keep saying that because I keep saying the exact same thing. You know, we're still, in some ways, we've made some advances, particularly in Afghanistan, in conjunction with our allies. So, for example, the Copenhagen Declaration and the Copenhagen Principles we've worked out with our allies in the context of NATO operations in Afghanistan. But that's not a long-term fix when we're talking about transnational terrorism, where we're able to use drone strikes in diverse places like the Philippines or Indonesia or Mali or Bangladesh or wherever else. So I think there's really two steps here. One is to really come to grips with the core underlying international law problems. And to be clear, they are difficult problems. We're not even engaging on those issues. And the second, this is just my opinion, is I really do think that the authorization for the use of military force, which Congress passed right after 9/11, really does need to be updated to reflect a new kind of enemy, a new national threat. To me, it's a long statutory stretch to keep twisting that old piece of statutory authority, which was designed for the 9/11 attacks and designed against al-Qaeda and associated forces. The more time that goes by, the more tenuous that connection. And I do think it's time for us to with our allies, get on more firm statutory ground as well.
Time for one more quick call with Gil on the line in Madison. Gil, hi.
Hi. I had a quick question about a particular detainee, because I've read this book called Guantanamo Diary, whether Mohamedou Ould Slahi has been released or is among those who may be released soon.
Gil, thanks for the call. Mike, I haven't been tracking the particular detainees that closely. Have you?
Not that particular detainee. There's a lot of books out there written by former detainees or by counsel who have consulted with them about things that did happen at Guantanamo. The caution I would have would be to look at the dates and the timing. Right in the aftermath of 9/11, there were some things down there that were questionable because the applicable law, Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, on its face absolutely prohibits torture or, by extension, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, which is a very broad category of treatment. What's not really talked about, publicly anyway, is the number of people, particularly servicemen, who have been prosecuted or disciplined for violating those rules. But a lot of that is in sort of modern parlance, ancient history. And that's one thing I credit President Obama with, is the clear executive order, and Congress responded with statutory changes in the Detainee Treatment Act. That stuff, misconduct at Guantanamo, hasn't happened for a very long time. But again, that's a big part of the problem, is that, you know, as General Petraeus would say, it's non-biodegradable. The stain of Guantanamo, the memory of Guantanamo, is forever etched both in the American consciousness and in the larger consciousness. So in some sense, there's a very real diminishing return to keeping people there. The effort to transfer them, and in that sense, is absolutely appropriate, but you still have to solve the underlying problem. What do you do with the 35 or so who are hardcore security risks that you simply cannot endanger the American lives and property by sending them back into the world?
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, appreciate your time.
That's Michael Newton. He's a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. He joined us to talk about the future of the detention center at Guantanamo Bay under the next president. You can still share your thoughts. Are you hoping to see Guantanamo Bay's detention center closed, maybe still under an Obama presidency or under the next president, whoever that might be? Let us know your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Today is National Tell a Joke Day, apparently to honor a Shakespearean actor named Joe Miller, famed for his wit and funny delivery.
So we thought we'd try our hand telling a joke or two on the air, and then we froze because we actually couldn't think of any jokes. It's kind of hard, so we went to the trusty old internet, and here's one I found. Four fonts walk into a bar, and the barman says, "Oh, get out, we don't want your type here."
Type. Here.
Get it?
Famed for our wit and funny delivery. Okay, here's one. I didn't come up with it. I didn't find it on the internet, though. Okay. A dog walks into a bar and says to the bartender, "Give me a drink." And the bartender says, "Whoa, a talking dog."
Oh.
Yeah.
So, and here's one aimed at you, Rob.
Uh-huh.
This is a variation on a tried and true one. What's the difference between a sax player and a roadkill squirrel?
What is that difference, Veronica, as a sax player myself?
The roadkill squirrel could have been on its way to a gig.
Ha-ha.
Yeah, now I see why we're not in stand-up comedy.
Exactly. Yeah, it takes that sort of the delivery and the knowing the words of the joke in advance. Yeah, there's many reasons why I'm not a stand-up comedian. The ability to tell jokes well on cue.
It's hard to tell jokes.
Foremost amongst them.
You got to have respect for the people who can do it for a living.
Send us a joke. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or message us on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. No joke on the Ideas Network.